From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. In our first half hour, we look at two new studies about relationships. UI sociologist Tony Peck found that married individuals are less likely to experience jealous feelings. But when they do, it's more damaging to the relationship. And a new study by UI psychologist Erica Lawrence found that for couples in their first few years of marriage, too much support is worse than not enough, especially too much advice. Then in our second half hour, we listen back to a conversation I had with former Iowa Poet Laureate Robert Dana. Dana died this past weekend at the age of 80. That's all coming up. First, a look at this hour's news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and this half hour, a look at two new studies that deal with relationships in our pre-Valentine's Day edition of The Exchange. My guests are both faculty at the University of Iowa. Tony Peck is an assistant professor of sociology, and Erica Lawrence is an associate professor of psychology. They join me in the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City. Good afternoon to you both.
Hi.
Thank you for having us.
Tony, if I might start with you, we know jealousy can't wait, so let's talk about jealousy in intimate relationships, a new study that you co-authored with, I hope I'm getting her last name correctly, Mariana Gatsova of the University of British Columbia, published online in the Journal of Sex Research. What aspects of jealousy did you study? What did you want to find out?
Well, we were interested in the distribution or prevalence of jealous conflict in a population. So it's a population-based data, which means it's a sample of individuals that's representative of a population. So this is the Chicago area. Mm-hmm. And we were just interested in how common or how prevalent jealous conflict is in this population. And then we were interested in its relationships with or associations with marital status and relationship satisfaction. So the general idea that we're trying to address is, to what extent was marital status associated with relationship satisfaction, and whether or not jealous conflict mediated those associations, meaning that some jealous conflict was more important in certain categories like marriage than in other categories like unmarried categories.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so these are people, the categories you had were married people, several hundred heterosexual couples in this study, I understand.
That's right.
And so the difference between married couples, how they deal with jealousy, how it plays a part in a relationship compared with people who are just living together or not married or living in separate places, maybe dating.
Yeah, it would be married couples, people who say that they're married, versus cohabiting couples that are not married, meaning they're living together, but mm-hmm. they're not married officially. And then the last category we call non-cohabiting, which would include people who aren't living together, but they might be together for a long time, or they just might be recently formed relationships that haven't moved to cohabitation yet.
So what did you find out about the way jealousy plays a part in these different types of relationships, these commitments?
Well, what we found was, the first thing we wanted to know was what was the relationship between marital status, these different categories, and jealous conflict. In other words, what category was more likely to experience jealous conflict? And what we found was that the cohabiting category had higher prevalence of jealous conflict
than the married category.
Than the married category, and as well, and the non-cohabiting category. Roughly half the cohabiting couples, individuals who were cohabiting at the time, reported jealous conflict mm-hmm. in their relationships.
How do you explain this? There's more security in marriage, less jealousy.
There are a couple reasons why. It's kind of a combination of circumstances. Cohabitation has – most cohabiting couples expect sexual exclusivity like married couples, whereas the non-cohabiting category has a greater proportion of them not reporting that they expect sexual exclusivity. So cohabitation has that expectation of sexual exclusivity in general. However, cohabitation is also associated with sexual concurrency, or some might call it sexual infidelity. So it kind of has it from both sides. On the one hand, it has high expectations of sexual exclusivity. By the same time, people don't remain monogamous in these relationships. Mm-hmm. So for those reasons, we expect higher levels of jealous conflict in cohabiting relationships. In addition, marriage might have a trust advantage, meaning that the partners are less likely to be suspicious of their partners than the cohabiting couples, where the cohabiting couples, because they don't have that trust advantage, are going to be looking for signs of infidelity. So jealous conflict might erupt even more frequently there, even after you control for sexual concurrency.
Is the only type of jealousy you were looking at of a sexual nature? Or are there different types of jealousy that you did or did not deal with?
Yeah, we were just looking at sexual jealousy. There could be other kinds of jealousy or envy as an emotion that might be associated with other phenomena, but it's not in our data. So it's just sexual jealousy.
Okay. Tony Peck is an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Iowa. New study looking at jealousy in intimate relationships. Professor Erica Lawrence, you have published a couple of recent papers about support in relationships based on a couple of studies. These are looking at couples earlier on in their marriage, in the first few years of their marriage?
Yes, couples. We followed couples over the first 7 years of marriage. Okay. Met with them annually.
7 years, right up to this first itch in the marriage.
Exactly, the high-risk period for distress and divorce.
Is that actually true, the seven-year itch?
Depending on the study, it's somewhere between a five-year and seven-year itch, actually. But
interesting. Not the focus of this conversation, but I'm glad we went there for a moment. What did you find about support in relationships among couples?
One of the things we found is that there's this myth that more support is better. And so we wanted to really look at how support might factor into how couples do over that seven-year period. And what really matters is the amount of support, whether it matches what the person really wants and the type of support. Having too much support, you know, so if your partner is trying to help you with a problem and you want space, that would be too much support or, you know, support you don't want. That's actually more detrimental to the marriage than not getting enough support.
Really? So you have this – the person who just doesn't wish that much support or wants to maybe reach out and ask for support instead of having it constantly at the doorstep being offered has a feeling of maybe a little suffocation or something like that.
Yes.
So that is a myth that this study sort of explodes, that more support is always better. And you think this is a myth in our culture? I would agree.
Yes. I think there's this – you hear the complaint that, you know, the person's not supportive enough. You should be more supportive to your partner. And in fact, more support is more likely to be a problem than too little support. So, yeah.
Did you find out by looking at this study that the type of support is important here, that it has to be tailored to the individual?
Yes, absolutely. It has to be tailored to the individual's needs, to the nature of the problem, to the level of stress associated with it, the chronicity, the perceptions. But there are different types of support that influence the marriage differently.
Mm-hmm. So what does that mean to tailor it? You mentioned a number of factors here, but for me in a practical sense, for our listeners in a practical sense, to tailor the support, what questions should I be asking when I look at my partner and identify, well, perhaps some support is needed right now? How do I identify the type, the amount?
I think the first thing is to know that there are different types. People don't really think about that. And to know that what you want is not necessarily what your partner may want. We call that the platinum rule. So because the golden rule would be do unto others as you would have them do unto you, but the platinum rule is do unto others as they would have you do unto them.
Uh-huh.
So asking what kind of support they want. So for example, if you're having a problem with a coworker, you might want to just sit and vent about it and have me say, you're right, you know, your coworkers, I'm so sorry you're so upset. We'd call that emotional support or esteem support. On the other hand, you might want to start figuring out how to resolve that and start problem solving and brainstorming ideas with me. That would be what we call tangible support. And so I would need to ask you what kind of support you want in order to provide you the right type of support.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there are a lot of couples around out there where this awareness is not there, where perhaps a longtime couple, a partner of many years, you might not know what type of support they need, and you're just Sometimes you get it right. Other times you don't.
Absolutely.
Because you're looking at yourself as the mirror.
Absolutely. What we found is that, people really don't think about the fact that there are different kinds of support to even offer or realize that their partner may want something different. A lot of people also don't know what kind of support they want. You know, so you have to kind of know what you want in that moment and what to ask for and that there are options, you know, and people don't know that as well.
People don't always know how to articulate the type of support that they need.
Exactly.
What you mentioned emotional support versus tangible problem solving support. What about this this idea in our society that women generally want? They want emotional support and the men, they want that problem solved.
I hold myths like that responsible for half of the divorces in this country, not officially, but I think they do so much damage. What we have found repeatedly is that those don't hold true. Some women may want that. Some men may want that. But there's such a variety of differences, in individuals. Mm-hmm. And depending on the situation, depending on the person.
Do you find any correlation with gender? In terms of tangible versus emotional support,
no.
The type of support, it really is a very individual thing. It doesn't matter your sex.
Absolutely. On average, yes.
On average.
Individuals may want different things, but yes.
Okay. And any other myths that you exploded quickly before we take our break?
Yes. One is that people assume that what you need to get good at is providing support. But we found that asking for support and being able to accept it is a skill that's actually more predictive of how the marriage does than providing support. So both are important, but asking for support is also a skill that you have to practice and get good at for the sake of the marriage.
Hmm. So sitting there as a partner and saying, I need support from my partner and saying, I'm not getting it, and complaining about that inside is really going to be a problem if you don't verbalize it. If you don't articulate it, if you learn to articulate it, you're in better shape.
Exactly. It's not just about providing support. It's about asking for support.
Okay. We want to come back and talk more with Professor Erica Lawrence, a sociologist, psychologist here at the University of Iowa. Tony Peck, assistant professor of sociology, talking about the nature of jealousy and support in relationships. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100 or The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. We'll be back in just a moment. Hey, jealousy. Hey, jealousy. Hey, jealousy. Well, tell me, do you think it'd be all right if I could just crash here tonight? You'd see I'm no sheep for driving. Anyway, I've got no place to go. And you know it might not be. I'm Ben Kiefer, and in just a few minutes, about 15 minutes, we listen back to a conversation I had a year ago with then Iowa Poet Laureate Robert Dana. Robert Dana died this past weekend at the age of 80. That conversation coming up in just a moment. 10 minutes or so more with our pre-Valentine's Day conversation about relationships. Two new studies, one looking at the role of jealousy in relationships, the difference that makes in married relationships versus cohabitating relationships versus non-cohabitating relationships. Also the role of support in relationships, exploding some myths that more support is not always better. If you'd like to join our conversation with a quick question or a comment on these topics, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Professor Peck, I wanted to go to you because you looked at marital status and the role
That's
of
right.
jealousy in also in the larger context of satisfaction in marriage, which has some political implications in our country, in our culture, always asking the question, are we happier, generally speaking, if we're married or not? What did your study say about that?
Yeah, that's kind of the second part of our study, which is looking at are the effects of jealousy greater in marriage versus non-marriage? And what we found was that the married couples suffered the most severe reactions in terms of their satisfaction, whereas the non-married couples, i.e. the cohabiting couples and the non-cohabiting couples, didn't really have very many negative effects of jealousy.
So jealousy is less likely in a married situation, but when it does come about, it's more damaging.
That's right. That's right. It marriage is protected from jealousy, right, in terms of like sexual infidelity, and it has that trust advantage. But when it does occur, the reactions are more severe in marriage.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you look at triggers of jealousy at all in here?
I'm sorry?
Triggers of jealousy. What typically triggers, in this case, we're talking about sexual jealousy.
Well, I mean,
is it a look, a comment? did you go that way at all with your exploration here?
Well, we're using population-based data. So unlike the rich measures that Professor Lawrence has, we have just a couple measures. And so the big trigger for us was whether or not the relationship was sexually exclusive. And I think that's pretty obvious. I mean, you would think that non-exclusive relationships would trigger jealousy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the biggest trigger,
mm-hmm.
for
mm-hmm.
sure.
What about – we asked about gender differences in support, types of support. What about jealousy? Do the – genders treat jealousy differently?
Well, there is a rich psychological literature on sex differences in jealousy, and as well as gender differences in jealousy. And so there is an argument that there might be an evolved sort of sex difference in jealousy. The argument goes that males would be more threatened by sexual infidelity, whereas females would be more threatened by emotional infidelity. And that's sort of like this evolutionary story. We didn't look at sex or gender differences specifically, and we didn't observe those in our data because we were looking at the occurrence of jealous conflict.
Mm-hmm.
So for us, what we are capturing is kind of the dynamic that might emerge in terms of a conflict between the partners.
Mm-hmm. And so when we talk about the application for these findings, what we find through this study, what might they be?
Well, certainly there are a couple applications. In another paper I did a couple years ago, the finding that we found was that jealousy is highly associated with violence, for example, so intimate partner violence. So essentially we're trying to look at the consequences of jealousy for relationships. There's some research on a pretty strong linkage between the two in terms of jealousy and violence.
Mm-hmm.
And I can think of one study that looked at like intimate partner homicide in Chicago over 29 years, and they found that love triangles and jealousy were responsible for 14% of the murders in that study. So it's a big motivation for
domestic violence
as well as homicide.
Mm-hmm. What are the other strong emotions we experience during marriage that may be the root of things that that we see later on?
Well, I'm not sure it's an emotion, but certainly just in the way people invest in each other is an important part of the story.
What do you mean by that, invest?
Well, marriages generally have higher levels of investments. People make joint investments in their friends and family. They make joint investments in property. They have children. They're more often likely to have children than in the non-married statuses. And so these investments mean that there's a higher level of commitment. And part of the story is that because of the higher level of commitment, it has this downside that jealousy can be pretty severe in the highly committed situations,
mm-hmm.
even though they're protected.
Professor Lawrence.
Some of the work we're doing sort of relates to that, because the study is embedded in looking at different kinds of relationship processes that couples engage in over time. So a lot of attention has been paid to being able to resolve conflict or problem solve, and that's where the action is. And a lot of couples therapies and preventions are on that. But things you said investment, yeah, things like being able to be supportive to each other over time, being able to trust each other and be emotionally intimate over time, quality of the sexual relationship. There are all these different domains that couples can have varying degrees of quality, mm-hmm. and that change over time and that influence who gets divorced or not, and how happy people are in their marriages, and all of the and you know, whether or not they're unfaithful. I mean, all of these other things.
Mm-hmm. Can you imagine, I don't think your study was about this, but if we look at the way Professor Peck looked at this in terms of support being or jealousy being different between married, cohabitating, non-cohabitating couples, is that also true of, you imagine that's true of support? There's a different level, a different understanding of support in a relationship in those three instances as well?
There is. We've looked at these same things in dating couples, in cohabiting couples, and it definitely is different. The complaints about too much support, too little support, you know, are pretty similar, but the implications for the relationship are much stronger for couples who are married.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas couples who are, you know, have only been dating a couple of months or something, they may say that they don't feel like the support, the quality of the support in the relationship is as strong, but it doesn't have the same damaging effects at that point.
Mm-hmm. Let's say you're out there. It's before Valentine's Day and you're in a young romance out there. Maybe you're just married or let's say an old romance. So let's not exclude that either. But what do you really need to pay attention to in terms of support? How do I know I'm on the right track or the wrong track in terms of support in my relationship? What questions would you ask?
There are several very specific things you can do. One is ask for what you want. Don't assume, you know, oh, if my partner loves me, he or she will know what to do, can tell I'm upset and know what to do. Ask for what you want. The second thing is to ask your partner, you know, what can I do for you right now? What would be most helpful? Do you want me to give you space? Do you want me to just sit here and listen? What can I do?
Mm-hmm. But there's some partners who will react and say, well, you love me. You're the person who knows me best in this world. Don't you know what to do? Because that, as you said, that person might, he or himself might not know what to do, mm-hmm. might know what advice to give.
Mm-hmm.
But you can ask the question.
Right. Right. You can ask the question. You don't have to. And the third thing is related to that is any of these kinds of relationship skills are skills. We tend to think that we're supposed to know magically how to be supportive, how to be good spouses, as if it's innate. You take driver's ed to learn to drive. It's a skill. Don't assume you're going to know exactly what advice to give or what to do in that situation. Practice it like driving a car.
Okay,
get good at it.
I have a feeling that Hollywood may be at fault a little bit for that.
Yes.
Do you think the romance picture that we get from Hollywood often is that we're supposed to know these things and they aren't necessarily skills, because skills would not be as romantic, would they?
No, that's true.
Well, I want to thank you very much. Very quickly, before we have to go, each of you, what do you look forward to studying in the future, Professor Peck?
Well, right now I'm looking at actually hookups and relationship satisfaction. So there's more studies on relationship satisfaction.
Okay, you. And Professor Lawrence?
Sort of grown out of my couples therapy practice, we've developed workshops to teach these skills to couples. And so we're just waiting to get funding to be able to offer that.
Okay, thank you for coming into our studio today. Professor Erica Lawrence, Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of Iowa, with a new study that looks at the nature of support in relationships. And Professor Tony Peck, his new study looks at jealousy in intimate relationships. Thank you for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up in just a moment, we listen back to a conversation I had a year ago with then Iowa Poet Laureate Robert Dana. Dana died this past weekend at the age of 80. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Iowa lost one of its major literary figures last weekend with the passing of Robert Dana. Dana served as the state's Poet Laureate from 2004 to 2008. Robert Dana was born in Boston in 1929. He was orphaned at the age of 8 and served in the South Pacific in World War II as a U.S. Navy radio operator. And after the war, he moved from Boston to Des Moines, where he attended Drake University and worked as a sports writer for the Des Moines Register. Later, he graduated from the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop and spent 40 years as poet-in-residence and professor of English at Cornell College in Mount Vernon. His book, Starting Out for the Difficult World, was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. That was in 1988. I spoke with then Iowa Poet Laureate Robert Dana just over a year ago and began by asking him about his approach to writing poetry in his latest book of poetry entitled The Other.
The poetry that has always fascinated me the most is the poetry I have begun calling in my late career improvisational. What jazz musicians mean by improvisation, or painters like Jackson Pollock, who compose as they go.
And trying to get rid of the conventions you might have in your mind.
That's right. You by getting rid of certain formal conventions, you get rid of certain mental and emotional conventions, because you actually don't know yourself where this thing is going. You're just you're following an instinctive line in your soul or in your head or in your emotions. And you have to trust those emotions and those instincts. And the other thing it means is that you have to risk blowing some bad notes.
Just like a jazz musician.
Exactly. I mean, you know, Louis Armstrong, Miles Davis, Art Tatum. If you listen to their old recordings, you can actually hear them blow a bummer or strike a wrong set of riffs. And in the old days, they didn't edit them out.
Right.
Part of the delight of this kind of work is that the human is still there.
Mm. Warm us up with one of the poems, please, from a section of the new book, The Other, called Beach Attitudes.
I'll take you to a Florida beach.
Oh, that sounds so good. Do.
Beach Attitudes. The title, of course, is a play on Beatitudes. Blessed is the beach, survivor of tides, and blessed the litter of crown conchs and pen shells, the dead blue crab in all its electric raiment. Blessed the nunneries of skimmers, scuttering and rising, wheeling and falling and settling, ruffling their red and black and white habits. And blessed be the pacemakers and the peacemakers, the slow striders, the arthritic joggers, scarred and bent under their histories, for they're here at last by the sunlit sea. Blessed Peoria and Manhattan, Ottawa and Green Bay, Pittsburgh, Dresden, and blessed their children. And blessed the lovers, for they shall have one perfect day. Blessed be the dolphin out beyond the furthest buoy, slaughtering the bright leapers, for they shall have full bellies. Blessed, too, the cormorant and the osprey and the pelican, for they are the cherubim and seraphim and archangel. And blessed be the gull, open-throated, screeching, scolding me to my face, for he shall have his own place returned to him, and the glossy lip of the long wave shall have the last kiss.
Funny, Iowa's poet laureate, a man who spent decades in Iowa sort of yearning for the water, Robert. Did you land in the wrong place?
No. Actually, I landed in the Midwest too late by several million years. I mean, this is an old seabed, you may recall, that we live on.
Well, you live in Coralville. You know that better than most people.
And I know that Leo Agassiz is responsible for the change in the name from Clarksville to Coralville, too. I actually once had to explain that to somebody over the phone in Florida. I was ordering some oranges and grapefruit, and she said, "Why is it a town in Iowa called Coralville?" And I was vain about it. I really was proud of myself that I could explain it to her.
Maybe a little incensed about it too. That you should know this in Florida.
No, I didn't think that. So. I didn't think so.
What is the magic of a beach for you?
I think what is more improvisational than the sea? Yes, there are tides. Yes, they come in. Well, I could make the argument metaphorically that the sea is both compositional and improvisational.
It has rules, but it's different all the time.
That's right. Well, yeah. It has rules, but it doesn't always observe its own rules. It sometimes improvises. And apparently from the science that we have been getting recently, the deeper we go in the sea, the more we find its improvisations. Creatures that are, you know, they're down there 650 feet and they're processing the blue spectrum of sunlight out of the pitch dark.
Right. There's something still there penetrating that depth. Yeah.
And it's creating forms that are totally improvised. I mean, they are adapting to all the changes in their environment as fast as they can. So that's part of the fascinating. But the other simpler answer is that I was born in Massachusetts and spent a little time on Cape Cod during the Depression. My mother was given a week in a cabin there on a stretch of beach. And it was probably one of the few times that life was beautiful and enjoyable. The rest of it, of course, it was by then, what, I was 6 years old maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So what year would that have been, 1931, 32, somewhere in there?
And then you were orphaned at the age of 8.
Yeah.
And then life took a turn.
Yeah, then life pushed me inland. And then I enlisted in the Navy to get further out. And then I came back and moved way inland.
Right.
And have been here more or less ever since.
Looking back in your time as Iowa's poet laureate, share a highlight or a two from the time. I know this request for an interview caused you to kind of look back over the few years you've been serving as Iowa's symbolic leader of poetry.
Well, of course, the most startling thing that happened to me during this period outside of a trip to China recently when I read and lectured at both Beijing University in the north and Shantou University in the south, hearing one's own poems recited in Chinese is bizarre. To say the least, although I'm very grateful to my Chinese translators and hosts for undertaking to do that. The most startling thing was a phone call I got a year or so ago from Jerry Addy, who runs something called the Public Policy Group, I think. It's not a government agency, but it's a lobbying group for, among other things, Iowa workers. And I didn't know Jerry then. He was calling me out of the blue, and he wanted to know if I would write a poem, a four-line poem, which would inculcate and praise the value of Iowa workers in Iowa and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I was totally stunned. Nobody had ever asked me to write anything of an occasional nature as the poet laureate. And I said, well, you've called the wrong person. Anytime I've ever attempted an occasional poem, it's been miserable, and I have never ever printed one anywhere or agreed to write one. Mm-hmm. And then he mentioned a certain sum of money, and I thought, this guy is very serious. This is not some cockamamie idea. And I said, look, I can't even think about this right now. It's beyond my comprehension. I'll have to call you back tomorrow.
I hope you will read us that poem for the Iowa Workers' Memorial.
the poem's called In Praise. In the field at midnight, in the lab at dawn, at the daycare, the brickyard, the office. We think it through. We sweat it out. We work our not-so-ordinary magic, growing old in the spirit of it. And the world knows us, and we stay and move on.
Mm, beautiful. Robert Dana, our guest, the remaining minutes of this hour, I'd like to, Robert, to ask you to go back to your new collection of work, The Other, and read something. We've had something from the section called The Other, from Beach Attitudes. You tried to warm us up on this icy winter day. From another section, perhaps, a piece you'd like to share with us?
Well, I will risk reading the closing poem if you think we have time. I'm done now with the dark houses of the East, my hometown. The book is closing on my generation. Skinner satin mills, long gone to producing brass and machine gun clips and bottle caps, are now themselves long gone. And the orchard of 10,000 apple trees that fed our insatiable boyish hungers, a wilderness of stumps and weeds. Even the rivers changed course, leaving Walpole's Cove bleached and dry, where, in winter, local farmers sawed thick blocks of ice, skidding them up a frozen ramp to waiting wagons. Horses named Belle and Sophie stamping and steaming and shaking their harnesses until they rang. My Polack neighbor's dairy farms, now a golf course, teas and greens and easy fairways. We once killed black snakes there through the long summers, and forking up corners, save the sweet-smelling wind-rowed hay from oncoming rain, chaff stinging our sweat-drenched bodies like shirts of nettle. So what's to say when a whole chunk of your life comes up missing? You say to yourself, well, there it is. Or, well, there it was, wasn't it? God's his own voyeur. After more than half a century, I walk the town with the only man who knows my name. Soon I'll bury my own shadow and slip away like sunlight. Simplicity's what I'm best at. In the end, a small box of a house by the sea. No electricity, no running water, dirt floored. Prayer, wind, and slapdash from the whereafter.
Robert Dana reading from his final poem in his new collection. The Other, the title of that again?
Elegy for a Hometown.
A lot of reflections in that poem, a lot of reflections throughout the book, coupled with instances, images of our modern times, Robert. If we go back and reflect on, you're coming up on 80 years of life, I think.
I'm afraid of it. No, I'm not. I'd like at least three or four more, personally.
let's give you a little treat. I'll ask you to take a vacation. If I would ask you to take a vacation to a favorite decade in your life, from the 30s on to the present, sort of, what would you like to pick?
Any of the decades involving my current wife, Peg Dana. We've been a lot of places. We've done a lot of things. Life has been as good as it gets.
Hmm. What is the kernel of your life right now that you, please don't take that away from me.
I'd like to keep going for, you know, as I said, three or four more years and write a handful of good poems and slip away in my sleep.
Slip away in your sleep. You wrote in that last poem, "Soon I'll bury my own shadow." When you talk to young people, either family members or young people you run into, what is, you know, young people these days, Robert, you and I both know, they don't often ask older folks for wisdom on how to live their lives.
That's probably because older folks don't have much wisdom. And the kids are smart enough to find that out.
If you could impart a bit of wisdom to whatever young individual would be out there, what would you say?
Find a way to be at peace with who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can manage that at some point, I mean, everyone goes through the chaos, emotional and otherwise, of being a teenager or being 20 or, God forbid, even being 30. If you can come out of that, out of those periods with a sense of who you really are and accept that and hopefully your friends, well, of course, your true friends will accept who you are. And those that don't, well, too bad for them. You know, have faith in the way you see yourself and go out there and do some good work in the world for yourself. Mm. Nothing succeeds like doing a good piece of work.
How late in your life did you gain that peace with yourself?
When I was 44.
right down to the year. Very good. 44. Any moment you want to share about the 44th year that set you on an easier course?
Well, I wouldn't say it was easier, but it certainly was different. I underwent a major abdominal surgery that removed 60% of my stomach and turned my plumbing around. And Peg Dana came into my life and brought peace and order and intelligence and a lot of good things.
We have, Robert, a little over a couple minutes to go. And maybe you can couple this with two things. Your view of the poet laureate's job in the state and with the advice. We don't know who the next poet laureate of the state will be. Maybe advice for that poet.
The way I see the poet laureate's job, it involves, first of all, work within the borders of the state of Iowa. You're out there to represent the art of poetry in the public area. This means talking and reading on occasion to business people in the business community, businesses. I once gave a talk and a reading at Pearson Solutions, for example, to writers' groups, to book clubs, book festivals. There's the being present at dedications, whether you write anything for the purpose or not, judging competitions, a task I finally don't want to do anymore, and I will be glad not to have to do that. I don't.
Sounds like your least favorite part of it.
Yeah, I don't judge poetry competitions anymore. I just refuse to do it. I have no great wisdom about that. Then there are the out-of-state trips that you make to, in say, Georgia or Florida, where you're giving readings. In 1 year, I did 18 of those, and they're always taxing and fun and informative, but you're carrying the flag of the state of Iowa, whether you like it or not. You're always introduced as the poet laureate of the state of Iowa. And then finally, of course, if you're lucky enough, there are appearances you make outside the country, such as the recent trip to China. So, you know, there's a lot to do.
Robert Dana, our hour has come to a close. What a great pleasure to have you back in our studio. I want to thank you very much for improvising with me this hour.
I love doing it.
My conversation in January of last year with poet Robert Dana. Dana served as Iowa's Poet Laureate from 2004 to 2008. Robert Dana passed away last Saturday. He was 80 years old.